Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And welcome to the Talk About Show here on KZSC Santa Cruz at UCSC. I'm your host, John Sandage, and my first guest tonight will be Dr. Dawn Motyka. So get out your pens and write this number down, 459-4036. We will be taking calls here shortly. That's 459-4036. And let's say good evening to Dr. Dawn Motyka.
And hello to you.
Glad to have you back in the studios with us. At this time, Dawn is with us once a month, so I hope you'll tune in every Wednesday and check to see if that's her week. But this is her week tonight, and we will be taking calls here in a few minutes at 459-4036. And we're going to start off, and we're going to talk about Zika. Not the dancer, but the mosquito.
Well, it's not the mosquito, it's the virus.
The virus, yes.
Yeah, but it's quite an interesting little virus because while it's been around for known for over 20 years, this recent connection with microcephaly was only noted recently. And it's very scary. We're not really quite sure whether it's a mutation.
Microcephaly.
Small brains.
That's my problem.
No. There used to be anyone from the generation, your generation, will remember, I think he was Zippy the Pinhead. It was a cartoon character.
Zippy
the Pinhead,
yes.
Right. And that is microcephaly. So you have a kind of a funnel-shaped skull, and the cerebral cortex is correspondingly small. Many of the people who were born with microcephaly are profoundly mentally retarded and often have problems controlling their bodies as well. So it's a very, very big disability, and it's non-lethal, which is
even worse.
Well, it's worse from a social public policy standpoint, because every time there is a Zika baby born in the United States, that's a lot of money.
And that baby can live to be 60, 70, 80 years old.
Yes, potentially.
Yeah,
especially with good medical care.
Yeah.
And so we really have a strong, strong interest in trying to just put the kibosh on this immediately, as quickly as possible. And it's already spreading in Florida. There are 30 cases that we are sure of. Pregnant women, just 30 cases of people who caught Zika hanging out on a nice nightclub strip. It started in one club and then jumped to the next club. And these mosquitoes don't fly very far. So essentially, it was an isolated person. Someone was actively infected with virus in their blood, got into a mosquito. That mosquito shared it with others. And other mosquitoes shared it too, probably. And so what we're looking at is something that you can make the argument because of global warming, but really, Florida was pretty muggy and mosquito-y beforehand.
Yeah.
So, you know,
it's going to move further north because of that.
It's going to move further north as we have global shifting in the tropical zone, and the areas get wetter, other areas get drier. They'll get less mosquito-y. There's a lot of variation coming down the pike. We're seeing things like dengue in northern Texas, which is new, and that's another mosquito virus. But the Zika one, you know, mostly these infections make you sick, a fever, a rash, a bad case of the flu. But that's it. In the case of Zika, it does something very, very different. It gets into the sperm stem cells. And so for the next 6 months, any sperm that man makes is infected with Zika. Now, it only stays in the bloodstream to be transmitted by mosquitoes for a couple of weeks. And after that, any individual with a normal immune system clears the virus and is no longer contagious via the mosquito vector. But the human vector problem is huge. There's so much we don't know about it. We don't know whether a woman if she's infected before pregnancy. Does it matter? Is it like if she's infected 2 weeks before the egg is fertilized? Could that baby be a Zika baby? We don't know when in the pregnancy she's most at risk for being infected. What we do know from the Puerto Rico data, which is really, really scary, is that this thing is really, really contagious. It has moved through Puerto Rico, there's 11,500 confirmed cases, most of them in Puerto Rico and a few in Florida in the United States. And many of them, they say 2,000 plus, were people who went to Zika-infected areas and then, you know, came back. But the people in Puerto Rico have been really hit by this very, very hard at a time when, of course, they have no funding. They're broke. And they have no money to be putting into public health campaigns to try to limit this. So we can expect a crop of Zika babies in Puerto Rico sometime in 9 months or so.
So if I understand this right, you have to be bitten by a mosquito, or can that person who was bitten pass it on to somebody else through
sexually? It's sexually contagious from male to female. And so it doesn't seem to go in the other direction, which is not the case of HIV, which can go either way, although the male-to-female transmission on most viruses is much higher than the reverse. But maybe there is female-to-male. We don't really know that yet because we haven't got – this is so new, and it's moving very quickly.
And are there other ways you can get it besides sexual contact?
Yeah, and that's the big – there is the rub, so the transfusions.
Oh,
and the FDA on Friday last week basically put out an edict saying that in 11 states, and that includes California, New York, Texas, Alabama, Arizona, and Georgia, and Louisiana, so some southern states, and also New York, because people travel to Central America all the time from New York. There's large ethnic communities there. So,
but that would affect, I can't remember if it's Houston or Dallas, but there's one of them has this huge airport, which all the flights from South and Central America land there, and then
it's a hub.
So wouldn't that be another place that it would be?
Well, that's probably why Texas is on the list.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons anyway, they've also got a southern border. But The blood supply issue is especially chilling because, let me tell you a little story. This goes back to the early 80s. We used to have this thing we called non-A, non-B hepatitis. It wasn't hepatitis A, which is spread from oral to fecal-oral contact. It wasn't hepatitis B, which is sex and IV drug use and contact with blood. You can get Hep B from cleaning up a nosebleed, which is why all teachers need to be vaccinated against Hep B. But we had this other non-A, non-B. We didn't have a vaccine for that one, and we still don't. But we didn't have a test for it either, and so we could not screen the blood supply. And so most of the people who got hepatitis C got it from transfusions. And we don't really have a good test for Zika yet. I mean, there wasn't one until the outbreaks in Central and South America. So now they've got like this very, very preliminary experimental test. No one really knows how good it is. No one knows how accurate it is. It's not been vetted. And that's what we've got to screen the blood supply. So this is, number one, I would not want to get a transfusion if I could avoid it anyway for a lot of reasons. But this is definitely the moment to think about autologous blood transfusions and donor-directed. But anybody who's been to South or Central America or Puerto Rico...
Or Southern Mexico, for that matter.
Well, anybody who's gotten bitten by a mosquito outside of Northern California. No, we don't. Yeah. It's not here. So the odds are very, very long that you could be infected. You could happen. You could be in the San Jose airport and a mosquito that made the trip from Brazil could come off of the airplane and bite you. But, I mean, those are the kind of long odds that you just don't worry about. But people get transfusions every day. There's something like 36,000 units of blood given every day in this country.
And is it all tested?
Not right now.
I mean, not for Zika, but for...
It's tested for Hep C. It's tested for AIDS. It's tested for the stuff we can test for.
Yeah.
We now have an experimental test that we're going to use and hope that it's pretty good, but we don't really know that for sure. We don't know what the miss rate's going to be.
So every time you give a pint of blood...
Yeah. It's going to be tested. And it's going to add to the cost of
the
blood.
That's an overwhelming amount of work.
It is. And it's coming down by fiat, and the states were basically told you have four. Those states, the first 11 states, were told you got 4 weeks to get this going. The rest of the United, the rest of the states have 12 weeks, 3 months. That's not very much time to ramp up something like this, get the reagents, get the kits out there. It's an overwhelming task. And last I heard, Congress was still not budgeting any money for this. So this is going to come out of the blood banks, which are effectively businesses, and the state coffers. This is not. This is basically having to go around Congress because, you know, God. It's like, God forbid, the current administration could successfully manage a crisis. I mean, this is reprehensible because we need to get on top of this. This thing is like an avalanche. Once it gets rolling and it's out there.
Well, it already is rolling, and it's just how much speed it's going to gain.
And it's not.
And so our federal government is not putting funds up to support.
Right. This is an unfunded mandate from the FDA.
Is there a reason? Have you heard a reason?
It's basically congressional gridlock for the most part. It's they don't want to vote funds for Zika.
And their grandchild is
I don't
born
know. I mean, you know, I haven't read the legislation. You know, John, maybe there's some sort of poison pill in there or, you know, funding for Planned Parenthood or something that's just a poison pill. I don't know.
Yeah,
the devil is always in the details with these things.
Yeah. Okay, so any more on Zika?
No, I think we've covered it.
Okay, do you want to go to the EpiPen and the $600 charge?
Yes, let's talk about the EpiPen. So,
First, explain what the EpiPen is.
I will. All right. So, first of all, the EpiPen contains epinephrine, which is a synthetic form of adrenaline, and it is the hormone that your adrenal glands put out in your fight or flight response. And the reason this is really useful is that when people have a massive allergic reaction, if you can give them a blast of adrenaline, you short circuit the allergic reaction. They don't go into shock, they don't start wheezing, and they don't die. So good things happen when you get adrenaline to someone who's going into anaphylaxis. The problem with it was, and it's been around since 1901, but it came in a little glass bottle and you had to know how to pull it out with a needle. And you had to get the dose right. And the dose is tricky. Too much is lethal. So if I give somebody, let's say, if I gave you three times the adult dose of adrenaline, which would be 1 cc, I'd probably kill you. If I gave a child the normal adult dose, I'd probably kill them. So that's creepy. And, you know, you can imagine in an emergency, your child is turning blue and, you know, pink and then blue, and you're trying to draw this up and you left your reading glasses in the car. So in 1980, the companies came out, and let's see, that first company that was Merck KGA. So this was not America's Merck and Company, but a different company, came out with a special device that was spring-loaded, and it was preloaded. All you had to do was slam the thing against your thigh and push a button. The needle would come out like a ballpoint pen. It'd go right through the leg, and right through your pants, and inject you. And
it
was automatic, spring-loaded, easy peasy. And for about 30 years, these cost $100 for a pair of them.
Or $50 each.
Or $50 each, yeah. And then, well, something happened. And what happened is greed on the part of the corporation. And not just greed, but really egregious. I mean, we're talking dead kids here. This is not anything to fool with. And the price was kept down by a competitor who was named AviQ, and that one got approved I think in around 2000. And they were the competition. They had a small share of the market, but their price was about the same, and so you weren't going to raise your price or you would lose your market share. They had some device failures in 2015, and so they voluntarily withdrew from the market. Nobody died, but they had sometimes the spring-loaded device either didn't deliver the drug or deliver. I don't know quite what the problems were, but they voluntarily recalled it. Went away from the U.S. market. They're still in Canada, I think. But that set the stage for just ratcheting up the price of the EpiPen to $600. And this is happening in a time when we have real serious issues with health insurance, okay? People, this is one of the big flaws of Obamacare, which maybe a little bit later we'll have a little critique of what's good and what's bad about Obamacare. But one of the bad things about the way it came down was that people ended up opting for high deductible policies. Often that's all they could afford, and they had to have a policy. So they end up with a $6,000 deductible before their insurance kicks in, and that includes the EpiPen. So they're paying for the EpiPen out of pocket. And it's really just an outrageous situation. So Hillary Clinton has actually been slamming them on social media, and looks like maybe we're getting some traction. The company has said, "Oh, well, we're gonna come out with a $300 generic version of the EpiPen," which is just totally bizarre because Mylan Pharmaceuticals is making the EpiPen, so. You know,
they're going to compete with themselves.
Yeah, and not to mention the fact that it costs nothing to make this device. Okay, maybe a dollar, and it costs nothing to make the drug. The drug is incredibly cheap. You can manufacture vats of it very cheaply. So this is all profit. And there was a generic company that was going out with their generic, and they were scheduled to go out this year, and suddenly. Oops! The FDA told Teva, "No, we're sorry. You even though we told you won the right to have a generic version in 2012 in the courts, and we said, well, I'll let you have it in 2016." The FDA refused to approve theirs, and it turns out that the CEO of Mylan is Heather Breach, and she has a relative in Congress.
Yes.
So, I'm sorry, we can't prove the fix was in. But she's making $20 million a year, by the way. That's her salary as CEO of the company.
Can't the government, I mean, I sound so naive here, but can't the government just say, no, you can't do that?
Actually, this was one of the lovely poison pills brought to us by George Bush in his first term. This is W.
Yeah.
And that was that he made it illegal for the United States to negotiate drug prices with pharmaceutical manufacturers. It is against the law. That was part of Medicare Part D.
I remember that. I'm still shaking my head from that. Why? How can they do that?
Every other country on the planet plays hardball with pharmaceutical manufacturers.
Except us. And we don't have to even guess why. Just follow the money, as the old saying goes.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah, well, it certainly appears that way. And to let it go up to $600, I mean, I don't see how anybody in Congress can allow that to happen.
Another thing Mylan did, which was rather advantageous to their market, was that they lobbied the states to pass legislation requiring schools to have EpiPens.
So you have to buy them.
You have to have them in the nurse's office, and the kids are allowed to bring them to school. So it's a
racket.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing if you're a company. Now, let's talk about drug profiteering. Now,
let me do this. 459-4036 if you care to join in the conversation. That's why we're here. It's a talk radio show. Come on, do your part. 459-4036.
So let's talk about Sovaldi. We mentioned hepatitis C in reference to the Zika. Well, hepatitis C is a stealth virus. It sits in your liver for 10, 20, 30 years. A lot of people never get sick, but a certain number of people show up 20 years after infection in fulminant cirrhosis of the liver and need a liver transplant. Liver transplants are very expensive. So we have a massive campaign going on right now. I would say Sovaldi and the pharmacy companies, this is Gilead Sciences, has been heavily, heavily lobbying the CDC to go and find Hep C cases. So doctors have been given a mandate by the CDC that we are now supposed to screen all adults born between, I think it's 1946 and 1974, for Hep C. We're supposed to just do that, screen them all. and we're going to find cases of Hep C, and they're going to need Sylvati. Now, Sylvati is a three-month course of injection therapy. It costs $80,000.
What is in it?
It's just an antiviral drug, kind of like the eight antiretrovirals that we use for HIV. It is a combination of interferon and another agent, and it's very effective at curing hepatitis C, which is awesome. And it's $80,000 a treatment, which is less awesome.
And way less awesome.
Way less awesome. And again, coming back to the year of deductibles, a lot of people, and there's this one case that I was hearing about in preparing for the show, I came across this story. And this is a woman, she's over 65, she's in Medicare. So you'd think she'd be okay. But because she's in an HMO and they don't and they have a high copay for this, because they're allowed to set the copays very high, it works out to $3,000 a month for this lady to be treated for her Hep C.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have, that's basically more than what she, that's more than she gets in a year. I mean, in a month. That's yeah. That's more than her income. So she would wipe out her life savings, which isn't very much, in order to pay for this treatment. Which, as far as I'm concerned, if she's Medicare age, she it should be covered for her.
Well, but why isn't it?
Because they didn't write the laws correctly to prevent people from being, defrauded by the insurance companies. I think I can use that word.
I think you can.
You,
I
you
don't
sign
think you'll
this
find
contract
many people who would disagree.
You sign this contract and you think you're going to get health insurance, and what you get is a piece of Swiss cheese. And unfortunately, you, at least, I don't know about you, but I have a big Swiss cheesy health insurance policy. And
well, I've been finding out that I'd have all of the things. I have the second policy. It still costs me like $300 or $400 a month.
And that's when there's nothing wrong with you. Wait
yeah.
until something happens.
No. Let me do this. 459-4036 is now working, and you can call in and talk with Dr. Don Motika. You can ask some questions or make your comments, remembering that it is a call-in show, and we really need you to do that part. 459-4036.
Okay. So one last cautionary tale on drugs. We'll talk about Martin Shkreli later.
Okay, let's take a call here. I think our phone was not working properly. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Thanks. First of all, how many injections does the EpiPen give you?
One.
Oh. Back to the Zika thing. Yeah, I know she said something about the flu, but Zika is not even like it. I'm not certain what the symptoms are of Zika, and I've heard it was similar to West Nile. Can you explain both?
Okay, well, West Nile's a little bit different in that it's a neurotropic virus, which means it can get into the brain and cause inflammation of the brain. And Zika doesn't do that. It's actually a kind of mild, self-limited illness. That's why I said that it was a bit like the flu. It's a bit like the in the sense that for most of us, the flu is a mild, self-limited illness. It puts us down for a couple of weeks, and then we bounce back. But, yeah, they're very distinct viruses. I didn't mean to imply that they were in the same family or anything. So West Nile gives you fever and a rash. Zika gives you fever and a rash. West Nile can infect the brain, tends to be mild in the vast majority of people who get it, which is also true of Zika. In fact, probably the vast majority of people who get Zika don't even know they've had a virus, which makes it even spookier.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and thanks for your call. Appreciate hearing from you, and that puts the lines back open at 459-4036, and now that the phones are working the way they're supposed to be, we'd love to hear from you. So you were starting out there on something else.
Have you heard of Martin Shkreli?
No.
Okay. So Martin Shkreli is a drug entrepreneur, and his company, Talent Pharmaceuticals, bought up this drug called Daraprim, which is an old, old antibiotic. Been around forever.
Is that the guy who kicked it up?
Treats toxoplasmosis, went up 100-fold, something like from $8 a pill to $800
yeah.
a pill. And this is another one that if you get toxoplasmosis, it'll cause birth defects. So it's rather good to treat it. And this is, I can do this. It's legal. And I have a captive market, and exactly analogous to the EpiPen case, except that it's just a much smaller captive market. And this one is maybe a little too big, but they've gotten away with it so far. And there's nothing on the books in the law of this land that can stop them. And I'm not holding my breath that we can get decisive political action out of anybody in an election year.
Well, when can somebody make the generic of that pill? Why can't somebody just make a generic pill out of it?
Well, it is a generic, but it's not a big enough market for it to be worth it for anybody to make a generic. See, that's what makes the Shkreli situation so frustrating. So, in other words, in order to get a generic approved, I actually have to make it and do analytic chemistry on it and then do testing and then show that to the FDA. And after about 3 years of paperwork and rigmarole, the FDA approves my version of the generic.
Boy.
So there's a lot of front end.
What a racket.
It's front loaded. And, you know, it's all there for our safety. It's all there to protect us, right? That's the
Well, we know it isn't. We know it isn't. We know it's a scam to make money. But there's not. You don't have much choice in the matter. Your doctor says, well, if you don't take this $800 pill, you're going to have some serious problems. And let's take a call here. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don. Where are you calling from?
I think one of the basic problems with either the drug or the insurance is that they are a corporation. So they have to show growth and profit on a regular basis. So that pits them against us. So that was just a statement of one reason that I think it's much, much deeper than one might assume. But with the toxoplasmosis, I saw this in an article in Scientific American that it lives and reproduces in the, and tell me if I'm right.
Yeah.
It lives and reproduces in the gut of a cat.
That's right. That's in fascinating.
In the gut of a cat.
In the GI tract of a cat.
Wow.
That's
Then it gets pooped out, and the parasite has to find its way back into the cat. So it migrates to the rat or mouse's brain, a mouse's brain, and the mouse or rat then has no fear of the cat. The cat goes up and eats it, and the parasite goes back into the gut.
That is exactly right. Now, it makes you think about how on earth could such a crazy life cycle be generated. I mean, this is true of a lot of complex eukaryotic parasites. They tend to be very selective about their hosts and their vectors, and they obviously can only come to be in a real sort of black swan set of circumstances that allow for this level of individualization. It's crazy.
That is the most bizarre.
I got more good stuff on toxo for you, though.
Oh, yeah. Great.
In that article,
It
also said that humans' brains can be changed by the toxoplasmosis. And they've said that, okay, these people were like this before the toxoplasmosis, and they became a little bit different personality.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes back to the Scientific American. It was a hookworm on the front of it, and it said, parasites rule the world.
Well, let me tell you about one of the features. You mentioned this mice lose their fear of cats. They also lose the ability to smell cats. And the humans who are infected with toxo generally have an impairment in their ability to smell cat pee.
Wow.
And,
well, that's not so bad.
Well, it explains cat ladies.
Oh, yeah.
That's a thing, right? You'll have people who have 30 cats, and the place is not clean. It smells, and there's cats everywhere, and it's kind of very creepy. There was a cat lady in my neighborhood.
Oh, I've been in one of those houses.
And
it's so creepy.
It's like, how could you possibly habituate to this? And the answer is she's effectively a halfway house for toxoplasmosis.
Wow.
Let's get a bumper sticker for that.
relative to the insurance companies, I worked in healthcare, and I stopped taking in all kinds of insurances about 4 or 5 years ago. I just don't do it. It's such a burden to go, please pay for this. And then they go, no, and you got to give us all the money back that we already gave you because you didn't dot your I and cross your T.
Mm-hmm. In fact, medicine is hemorrhaging doctors right now, and I'm sure other professionals as well. many people are just closing down their practices, or they're going to work for large entities that can afford the armies of minions that, you know, that go to war with their code books and their computers against the insurance companies and track everything. It's become just absolutely nuts. And the amount of money that is wasted. I mean, today I wrote a prescription. Actually, yesterday I wrote a prescription for a muscle relaxant for a lady with back pain. She's in her 70s, and today, and this is a cheap generic drug, and today I got back a prior authorization. Now, I get these whenever I write estrogen for a lady over 65 now. I have to do a prior authorization. And what the prior authorization is about 20 minutes of time, me sitting on the hold, eventually talking to a human. They take all my information, then I sit on hold some more. And eventually what they say is, are you aware that this drug can be sedating and is not recommended in the elderly? And I'm like, yeah, I'm a doctor. Thank you very much. I'm aware. And then they authorize it. And so, but that's a tax. That's a time tax. That is, so I've begun telling patients, as I will tell this lady, just go pay for it. It's going to cost you $8, you know, but half an hour of my time, I simply can't spare. I'll pay for it for you.
Here's your eight bucks.
I've gotten to that point. It'd be cheaper on the overhead.
Well, thank you for being in practice.
Oh, and thanks for your call.
Thanks for the call. Great question. Bye-bye.
One of my early jobs was a claims adjuster at an insurance company, and I was mailed the checks. And so they would tell me, my instructions were to delay it.
Right.
Send it out unsigned so it has to come back. And
mm-hmm. Actually, nowadays the instructions are literally, because there have been several whatever people who've outed them on this, deny it the first time, no matter what. You always deny it. You make them appeal it.
And then you get a month or two interest.
Well, there's that, and there's also the fact that sometimes, you know, the person gets better and you don't end up having to pay for it, or they die and you don't have to pay for it.
There you go. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don, alive and well.
Hi, yeah. I'm just wondering if you could explain a little bit about how breastfeeding mothers, like maybe the elements, I suppose, that they take in might be affecting their babies?
Well, yeah, and I didn't mention that we do think that maybe you can spread Zika through breastfeeding, and there's a couple of ambiguous cases. The virus is very, very small. It can get into, it's in your bloodstream. That might be the moment it can get into your milk. There's a whole lot of really important things that are in breast milk. The proteins are particularly digestible, and the breast milk also contains special carbohydrates called prebiotics that help select for the bacteria that you want to inoculate into the baby. And I find this fascinating. If a baby is born through a C-section and you don't breastfeed them, that child has a tenfold, that's 1,000% higher chance of having allergies and asthma than if that child was breastfed. So if you have to have a C-section, because the best way to inoculate the baby is through the vagina, and, you know, on the way through, you get all kinds of bacterial exposure. We used to sterilize the vagina back when I was first taught to deliver babies. We were swiping the vagina with betadine because we thought it was dirty. And, you know, that's just crazy, but that was how I was trained. We dropped that about 5 years after I started. But that used to be standard procedure. And that was a bad idea. But coming back to breast milk, it is a much more digestible food. The babies are biologically designed to be able to absorb it, and it does contain antibodies to things like measles virus and others. Whatever's in the mother's bloodstream, antibody-wise, comes through to the baby. And since that infant's newborn immune system is very unable to react properly to the sort of things like the colds and the, like I said, the measles and the whooping cough and all these other things. If you have a vaccinated mother, whooping cough, unfortunately, it doesn't work for, but that's a different conversation. Do you have any other specific questions about breast milk?
Well, I was wondering actually about if a mother is needing to take like a prescription medication and antibiotic type thing, how that might affect breast milk?
Well, I generally encourage women to pump and discard while they're on antibiotics anymore. And if they can get, you know, tide them over breast milk from La Leche or something like that, you know, buy breast milk on the market for a couple of weeks and just Well, there's a lot of donated breast milk out there. I don't know specifics of how to access it. If someone has that information and wants to call in and tell us, that would be great. But I really try to avoid antibiotics now. I actually feel guilty when I give children antibiotics. I mean, if they've got a life-threatening, you know, pneumonia or something, I deal with my guilt. But I know I'm going to have to rehab that child's gut. And I work really hard to be proactive with my patients, get them to take probiotics and prebiotics when I give them antibiotics, because this is like going into a rainforest or a beautiful rose garden with a flamethrower and just going psst, one good swipe across the rose bushes, and yeah, you get the weevils and the insects and the aphids and all the things that are eating the rose bushes, but you also get the rose bushes. So fortunately, we can as adults recover, but that critical period in childhood when we get our imprinting is not possible to get back. So we really, really need to concentrate on the infant microbiome. And breastfeeding is the simplest, most biologically appropriate way to do it.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Appreciate
hearing from you.
And I want to just point out, if you look up the package insert for the drug, it will say whether it comes out in breast milk. So every single drug, that information is available either at the pharmacy or online. And you just have to type drug name, package insert, and then search that file for breastfeeding, and you'll know whether or not that drug is even available to the baby in breast milk.
And you are on the air with Dr. Don. Thanks for your patience.
Okay.
Hi there.
Great. Quick question. Well, no, of course it's not a quick question.
Thank you for realizing that.
Not with me, I'm afraid.
The question is regarding PSA levels.
Okay.
I'm going to have to face my doctor next week, and I have probably a PSA level of about 5 or 6. How serious is that?
Well, how old are you?
I'm 66.
All right. Probably not too serious, okay? If you were 36, we'd be a little bit worried about you, and we'd wonder if you had an infection of the prostate, and we'd be worried about an aggressive prostate cancer. But as you get older, the prostate gets bigger, and so the amount of PSA goes up. And a level of 4 or below is considered normal for a 66-year-old male. Yours is a little high, which means that your prostate might be a little big, not exactly rare in your age group. And there is a very small chance that you could be catching a very early prostate cancer. And I do want to emphasize it's a small chance. That the odds are higher if you have a family history of prostate cancer. So that's something to factor in here. But the next thing that your doctor will probably want to do is a second test. This is how I proceed. I don't know what your doctor will do, but there are some secondary tests. Usually I will get a percentage-free PSA, and this will give us a basically a probability that this is a cancer. And so depending on how much free PSA you've got, and I always get it reversed, I think, and so if I've gotten this backwards, spot me, because I always have to double check it. But the higher the percentage free PSA, the higher the chance of it being a cancer. I think that's correct. So what you do in that situation is maybe you move to a biopsy. Or on the other hand, if the PSA is low, the percentage-free PSA is low, then which it would indicate that this is just an enlarged prostate, then you heave a sigh of relief and get another test in a year, or maybe 6 months. So PSA can go up and down a little bit. It'll go up after sex. It'll go up after a digital prostate exam. So we've learned as doctors not to get the PSA the day after that test. Sometimes I've had people have a high PSA and we repeat it a week later and they're like, oh yeah, I was really constipated and I had a big bowel movement that morning. So anything that pushes on the prostate could conceivably kick the level up a percentage point. So you always want to get the test after you've been regular and haven't had a rectal exam.
Uh-huh.
Where would you like to head now? We've got about 15 minutes left.
Well, let's talk about this research that came out about This is about states that have medical marijuana and states that don't. Compare and contrast. Extra credit if you can make a political point. So Ashley and W. David Bradford, a daughter-father pair of researchers at the University of Georgia, did this work. They went through the database of all prescription drugs written in the country by every single doctor. And there's a database for that. The drug reps know whether I write their drugs or not. They have access to the database as well. So this is not private. And anyway, so if you compare states where there is medical marijuana, you find something really striking. And it happens after the states get changed. After they get the medical marijuana law, sales, or rather prescriptions for a number of drugs drop. Painkillers drop a lot. Almost 2,000 fewer prescriptions per doctor per year.
Whoa, for that's a huge
Vicodin.
Number.
Yeah, 2,000 prescriptions of Vicodin or Tylenol, codeine or OxyContin or whatever is the drug du jour.
Man.
2,000 per doctor per year. That's a lot.
Absolutely.
That's
yes.
a lot. You also have about 265 fewer, on the average, antidepressants written, and 562 fewer doses of Valium or Ativan or other anti-anxiety drugs. 541 fewer anti-nausea drugs which I would say, which I want to emphasize are associated with dementia and adverse side effects. 486 fewer seizure medications per doctor per year. So it's very interesting because if you look at medical marijuana, companies that have been lobbying against medical marijuana, that is the big company is the one that makes the synthetic THC. And they've been lobbying very hard against it because
they
would lose their product. They fund things like the Community Anti-Drug Coalition of America. That sounds like, you know, that sounds like a grassroots organization.
It's people getting together.
It's
right?
not. So here's the scoop. If you look at the money that wasn't spent on prescription drugs, it works out to about $165 million a year. Now, if you extrapolate that to all 50 states and figure it would be about the same proportion, that's $500 million. $500 million is 0.5% of all Medicare Part D spending. So you would save so much money. Actually, you know, you're not paying for the marijuana. The people are going out and paying for the marijuana because it works better than the prescription drugs for those individuals. And I think there's a lot of variation in response. And I'm not trying to tell anybody they have to smoke marijuana, but I'm also saying that it's very clear that it may be the lesser of two evils in many clinical situations. And I certainly think it's time to legitimize it across the country.
Well, we're working hard on it, and you've been working on that for a long time, along with Ben Rice and so many people in our community and throughout the state. And we're getting there. We're finally getting there. But when you hear something like this company that makes fake THC, that they want to put up a lot of money so we can't have the real thing that really works, they've got such a lousy product, they've got to spend a lot of money to keep it on the market.
Oh, and it's really expensive, too.
Well, of course, because they're the only ones who could sell it for a long time, and now they're going out of business.
Yeah, well.
Bye-bye. Now if we could do that with the EpiPen people, 459-4036.
I got your blood up a little bit with that story,
you
didn't
did. You can get it up pretty easy, you'll find out. Somebody's calling right now, so let's take them and put them on the air. You're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi there. I was wondering something. It seems like me and my friends spend a lot of money on prebiotics and probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering sometimes if that's just kind of not specific enough. And I'm just wondering how far they've gotten in sort of cataloging the flora and the fauna in our gut.
Oh, they've gotten pretty far.
And making correlations with
issues. Very good question. It's going to be complicated and multifactorial, which it makes the science very challenging. We do have DNA fingerprinting, which will tell us what's in there and in roughly what proportions, which is really useful. And we're starting to assemble profiles, kind of like genetic like the genetic testing. If you remember the O.J. Simpson trial 20 years or so ago, those the level of genetic testing that was being done then is now can be done very, very quickly, and you can analyze stool and list all of the bacteria that are in there. When you talk about translating that science information into an actual product that you can consume, you run into some real difficulties. Chiefly, that most of the bacteria in our intestine are anaerobic. They are oxygen haters. Oxygen is, in fact, toxic to them. Once upon a time, this planet didn't have a lot of oxygen on it. And then those pesky blue-green algae in the ocean started making oxygen. And those bacteria that were all over had to go hide from the oxygen. So they went into the soil. They went underground. And they ended up in our guts as well. And they became very important commensals. But a lot of them are anaerobic, so it's difficult to culture them. It's difficult to make them. You can't just grow a vat of them the way you can grow a vat of E. coli or lactobacillus. So a lot of the probiotics that you see out there are limited to the probiotics that we can actually make, which is nowhere near the mix and the combo that we have in our guts.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best things you can do is consume prebiotic food. These are this is fiber, non-absorbable fiber that you can't break down, because basically starch is a fiber, but you can break that down into sugar and absorb it. But something like inulin or arabinoglycans, these are compounds that you don't have the enzymes to break down.
What are those?
Well, inulin, for example, is a starch that you find in kiwi and jicama. So I'm always telling people, throw a kiwi in your smoothie. Eat jicama in your salads. You get inulin.
Wow.
That helps stimulate the growth of not just the aerobic guys, but the anaerobic guys that we can't culture outside of your intestines. So until someone makes a kind of intestine in an anaerobic environment factory, we won't be able to grow something that mimics what we carry around inside us. We can seed it with spores and things like that, which is why eating a little dirt is good from time to time, because that's where these things are, is they're in the soil. So maybe we shouldn't always wash our hands before eating.
Well, isn't that something that's come up?
Soil-based probiotic that I know of.
Mm-hmm. But it's still not going to have any, it's still not going to have the anaerobes.
So is it useful and wise to take probiotics?
It depends on what circumstance and what your individual situation is. If you have healthy digestion and you're not having any GI problems, you don't have allergies, you don't have autoimmune disease, you may have a pretty good microbiome, especially if you breastfed as a child. So when you need to do something is probably under circumstances when you go off or when you feel like there's a perturbation. Let's suppose you have to take antibiotics and you get a yeast infection and your bowel movements change and you're starting to get a little crampy here and there's some gas now and then. You've probably disrupted your microbiome. And that might be a circumstance where taking some probiotics and some prebiotics would help readjust the balance. Now, there was a show on Terry Gross recently that made the statement that probiotics, that we don't know enough about them and they don't really work. And I thought that was, it was written by a science writer who doesn't understand medicine. He understands how to do a Google search and read scholarly papers, but he doesn't understand clinical medicine. There's tons of evidence, for example, for asthma, eczema, allergies, autoimmune disease and Crohn's disease, all sorts of things that show that probiotics are beneficial and do improve clinical outcomes.
Wow.
So in particular, the strongest evidence is for this really awful disease called Clostridium difficile. This is the one that the FDA approved the poop transplants for.
Yeah.
The fecal transplants, because it is so nasty and we can't kill this thing once it gets established inside people. And if you take a particular yeast, which is Saccharomyces boulardii, you will lower your risk. I can't say you will not get this when you take certain antibiotic like Cleocin, but you're much less likely to get the C. difficile, and that's statistically a very valid study. So I think we're in our first baby steps to understanding this, and if we continue with the research and the tools that we've currently got, I really have no doubt that we will be treating microbiomes maybe more with things that encourage them rather than with just seeding them. I don't think seeding is going to work as well as maybe changing the diet to push the probiotics in the right direction.
Mm.
I use a lot of plant botanicals if I'm treating GI problems where I think it's the microbiome that's gotten thrown off. But those plant botanicals, you don't want to just go get a bunch of oregano oil at the health food store. You can actually do more harm than good. So it needs to be a bit more nuanced than that.
Hey, thanks for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. And I want to get one question in before we go. I read this in
Host's
the paper.
Host's privilege.
Yes. 250,000 deaths a year by accident or mistake in the hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that a right number?
It's probably an underestimate. It's very, very, very complicated to do everything right in a chaotic situation with multiple inputs, multiple outputs. I was on the hospital board of directors for 6 years, and the hospital continues to work, all of them do. They continue to work really hard to error trap and develop systems to prevent mistakes. But there's just things like, you know, you mentally, you have it, okay, that's the right side of the patient, you flip the patient over, and now you need to go to that side, which is now the new right side of the patient, but you don't. Or you don't know which end is up, you walk in, you take off the wrong leg. I mean, I think
we've heard those stories.
We've heard, those are not anything that anybody does on purpose.
Well, of course not, but 250,000 is so...
It's frightening as hell.
When I heard that number, I thought, well, maybe you should take a zero or two off there, but...
No, a lot of it has to do with idiosyncratic responses to agents. So, for example, something that worked perfectly well in you and Richard and John, but then you give it to Jerry, and Jerry grabs his neck, turns blue, and you know, has a heart attack. And this is a idiosyncratic reaction. He metabolizes the drug a little bit differently. He has characteristics in his system that we can't ascertain because our technology isn't there yet. It's close to being there, but we don't have the rapid throughput to like look at how a person's processing their drugs before we give it to them. And we need that, but we aren't there yet.
Well, that seems to be the case with most drugs. Even cannabis is... Each plant puts out different characteristics, and each body that takes any of that cannabis has different characteristics. So it's impossible to keep up with all of the things that go on. But we're going to keep at it because you'll be here again next month, and we'll have another hour to talk with you. And what is your website?
My website is Optimage Health. That's optimagehealth.com. And I also have AskDrDon.com.
Oh,
so if you want to ask a email question, which I put out a podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast at AskDrDon.com. If you want to ask an email question, that's where to go. And I do email podcasts and put those out once or twice a month and answer all those questions.
And she'll be here to do the same live. And I really appreciate you taking the time. I think this is such a good thing for our community to be able to hear the things you have to say and the way you explain them. And I appreciate your time. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the venue.
We'll do it again.
Forum.
We'll do it again next month.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans. Or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.